The startup economy is vast. Every day, over 130,000 new ventures are launched around the world. That's around 50 million startups a year. The image of the startup is cool, but the reality is that 120,000 implode every day too. There are many reasons for the 90% fail rate. Founders often fall in love with their ideas, tuning out evidence that their product doesn't solve a problem that customers care about. They may lack the experience or drive required to run a business, which is, as any business owner knows, hard. Or they may fail to find the money because their story isn't compelling enough. In this show, we talk to someone who helps startups understand these pitfalls and builds a persuasive case to find the money. So, if you're a budding entrepreneur or want to create a venture within your organization, tune into this great conversation with James Church. And don't forget to download his free book, Investable Entrepreneur, which contains a valuable set of resources.
Hey folks, welcome back to the Evolving Leader Podcast, the show born from the belief that we need deeper, more accountable, and more human leadership to confront the world's biggest challenges. I'm Scott Allender.
And I'm John Gomes.
How are you feeling today, Mr. Gomes?
I am feeling fantastic. As I said to another guest earlier this week, I am now 5 out of 5 nights having had full, high quality, deep sleep. And I'm feeling terrific. I'm going into the weekend with, you know, with something in the bank, which is brilliant. So yeah, I'm feeling really good.
Nice.
How are you feeling, Scott?
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling light on this Friday. I feel like some challenges this week, but they were all addressed and we got through it. And I feel really satisfied that there was a lot of good work done. So I'm feeling light and energetic and anxious and eager in a good way to talk to our guest today. Today we are joined by James Church. James is on a mission to prevent great ideas from failing due to poor communication. He believes that too many founders fail to raise the capital they need because they're unable to convince investors that their business is the one they should back. He is the co-founder and COO of Robot Mascot, a global award-winning investment readiness agency, and claims that his clients are 30 times more likely to raise investment than the average startup. He regularly contributes to Forbes, Entrepreneur Magazine, and numerous industry blogs. He runs a mentoring sessions at Google Campus, Tech Hub, and mastermind sessions for Founder Institute, the Design Museum, Dent Global, and Chartered Institute of Marketing, and the University of East Anglia. He's also the author of the best-selling book, Investable Entrepreneur, which we will explore with him in detail today. James, welcome to The Evolving Leader.
Amazing. Thank you for having me. Thrilled to be here.
James, how are you feeling today?
I'm feeling good. Yeah, it's been a good week. Yeah, feeling really good. Thank you.
Excellent. Just before we get into all of this, we've got to find out what Robot Mascot means and where that came from, where that name came from.
Well, I'm going to have to credit my business partner, Nick, for that one. He's the creative of the two of us. He comes from a brand and advertising background, worked top 10 agencies in London. And I mean, he'll tell the story better than me, but I'll give it my best shot. We work with pioneers, right? We like to work with pioneering individuals trying to challenge the status quo, do things differently, looking at the future in different ways. And that's where the robot part comes from. But obviously robots in a lot of films kind of are the bad guys. They take over the world. They destroy the humans. So that didn't seem to be very good for a service-based company that was the friend and ally of founders that wanted to be their biggest fan and support these founders to succeed. So we added the kind of the mascot part to represent that part of the business where we're the fans, we're the mascots, we're there to cheer them on. And those two things blended together sounded pretty good. So it kind of stuck. So yeah, that's the story.
Thank you.
I like it. It's memorable. I like it. So let's, if we could, can we start with how you became a startup coach? And I'm specifically interested on your intentional focus on communication. How did that come to be?
Yeah, so look, Robot Mascot started life as a branding agency. We were working with brands to elevate their communications. And because we wanted to, you know, when we started, our profile of ideal client were these pioneers, and that naturally led us to working with startups, creating their brands, and as we helped them communicate their offer to their audience, it was only natural that they started asking us to help them communicate their offer to investors. So we started doing some pitch decks. To be honest, we had no idea, no finance background. I'm from a brand and marketing background, as I said, my business partner, brand and advertising. So we didn't really know the space very well, but we kind of figured it can't be any different. You've got a thing you're trying to sell here, a product, which is your shares, and you have an audience that want to buy those shares, the investors. So all we need to do is understand the audience that we're selling this product to. It can't be any different to any other advertising or brand campaign that we've done. So that kind of got us in the space. And what we realized quite quickly was that founders weren't great at communicating their ideas in a way that investors wanted to understand them. And that led us on a journey to really understanding the mind of an investor, who that target audience was. And to cut a long story short, after years of research and development into our approach and process, we kind of figured out a formula that really helped us create content that resonated with investors and allowed founders to translate their idea and their passion and their goals into the language of an investor that made them see the value in the shares that they were pitching to them.
Given the financial climate at the moment that we're in, what are the prospects for startups today, and how is that dynamic between the entrepreneur and the investors looking?
I think that's always a really interesting question, because you look at the financial climate today and you kind of think, you know, it must be a pretty terrible time to be going out and raising investment. And you might look at the data and go, well, compared to last year, it's not so good. And compared to the year before, it's not so good. But if you take a longer term view and look at maybe a 10-year picture, what you see with the trends is, during the COVID years, sort of 2020 to 2022, there was a huge spike in the amount of investment that was happening across Europe, globally actually, but if we just focus on Europe, it was about three times as much than 2019 in 2020 and 2021. Incredible amount of funding. So when you look at the amount of funding being invested today, which has dropped down, you can create clickbait headlines saying investment is down 30% year on year, 40% year on year, those sorts of clickbait figures. But if you were to compare it to pre-COVID, when things were a bit more normal, we're actually up something like 17% year on year on early stage funding, 2023 versus 2019. So there's this weird little bit, this thing that happened. Everyone was sitting at home, didn't know what to do. So they were investing in startups. I don't really know why it happened. It did happen. There was a trend that hedge funds, PE firms were taking advantage of all of the additional capital that had been pumped into the market by government. And they had, for whatever reason, decided to start investing in startups. And that meant valuations increased, round sizes increased, and we just went through this weird little boom period. And things have just settled back down. And actually, compared to where we were in 2019, last year was a really, really good year for startup funding. And 2019, everyone was super excited. It was a record-breaking year. It was the fifth record-breaking year on the trot. We were just seeing investment in startups going up and up and up. Had COVID not happened and we were where we are today, everyone would be celebrating a record-breaking year, investments up 10, 15, 17%, whatever the figure is, I can't quite remember. We'd have a completely different outlook on what's happening in the market. So yeah, it's important to always look at these trends, both in the short and the long term. So yeah, 100%, it's harder to raise money now than it was 2 years ago, but it's also easier to raise money now than it was pre-pandemic. So it depends really how you look at it as to what narrative you want to spin. And being someone who focuses on communication, it's always about narrative and spin, right? How do you How do you position it? What time frame in that data do you use to present the growth of your business or the opportunity for raising investment and the market data? So yeah, it's always interesting to me to see how just changing the time frame of something, you completely change the narrative.
So in your book, you start by saying that entrepreneurs must invest in high quality funding assets to stand a chance of success. What are these, and why do some seem to struggle to get these basics in place?
Yeah, so there's three critical fundraising assets that I talk about. The first is the business plan, then we have the financial projections, and then we have the pitch deck. So the job of the business plan is essentially to help you as a founder better understand your own business so you can articulate it concisely to an investor. You understand all the moving parts. The number of investors that might actually read your business plan is probably fairly minimal. Read it cover to cover, if you like. But the purpose of going through writing a business plan is that you can start to see all the critical moving parts coming together. You can analyze your strategy. So when you're asked a question by an investor in the due diligence process, you've thought about how you articulate that part of your business. So it levels you up. It makes you more credible. It really helps in that due diligence, that scrutiny that you're under after the pitch. It also forms a really solid foundation for the thing that founders really struggle with, which is their forecasts. Because they're sitting there in front of a blank sheet of paper trying to create this second asset I talk about, the financial projections, got a blank spreadsheet in front of them or an empty template, and they're thinking, well, I don't know, how am I going to grow? I'll put in X percent growth a month, or what cost do I need? And they're just sort of trying to make it up on the fly, and they don't feel comfortable being able to back themselves up in front of an investor. So when an investor says, well, you're growing too quickly, there's no way you can grow that at that speed, they go, oh, I'm ever so sorry, let me redo this and I'll send it back to you. That doesn't show confidence in create confidence in the investor. Instead, they want to say, well, based on the business plan we've written, all the research we've done, all the considerations we've done around X, Y, and Z, you're right, this growth is ambitious, but we believe it to be achievable because of all of this information that you can reel off as a result of your business plan. So the business plan becomes the foundation of a credible and solid set of projections and enables you to create these forecasts that are much more compelling. And these forecasts themselves need to be fairly detailed for the European investment market. There's a bit, you know, different culture to the US, for example. So in the US, you find 80% of early stage investors are ex-entrepreneurs. It's more about the vision and the rolling with the punches of entrepreneurship. Whereas in Europe and the UK, 80% of investors come from the city. They come from the finance background. They love spreadsheets and numbers and number crunching, and that's their world. So their expectations on these documents are very different. And then you've got the final asset, and that's the pitch. And the pitch is obviously there to summarize all of this detail in a clear and compelling and articulate way. But the mistake founders make on that, the biggest mistake they make, is they're pitching for investment. And you're never really pitching for investment when you pitch to an investor. What you're pitching for is time. You're pitching for them to engage enough in you and your idea and deliver them enough credibility about you and your intentions that they want to invest their time in finding out more about it, going through the forecast, going through the business plan, asking you questions, seeing if they want to take an actual stake in the company, seeing if they want to invest. So you're really pitching for the opportunity to convince them later down the line to invest through these other assets, the business plan and the projections. They're what close the deal. The pitch opens the door and buys you the time you need to get them over the line. And I think a lot of founders think the pitch is the only thing they need, and it's like Dragon's Den or Shark Tank or whatever it's called in your country. And there's a stack of cash on the table, and if they say they're going to invest, they walk out the room with the money in their hand. And the reality is, 20% of the deals that go that seemingly get investment on TV actually go through due diligence and end up closing, and that's because of all of the other stuff that gets missed. And that's really what the book is about, is how to use these assets as sales collateral for selling those shares, so that they're essentially your presentation document, your pitch, your brochure, your proposal document, all of the things you would need to make a sale in a B2B environment. That's essentially what these are. They're communication tools to get an investor to trust you with their money, essentially.
So are you saying only 20% of the stuff I see on Shark Tank actually happens?
Something like that. I don't know the exact figures, but the vast majority of them never go through because something comes up in due diligence. They pitch a good idea. They tell a great story. The investors are excited to take things further. In a real world scenario, that's called an expression of interest. They go, I'll formally express my interest in this round and I'd be able to contribute X towards the total. And now let's go through a series of due diligence. That's boring for TV. So TV is like, yeah, I want to give you the money, right? So no one wants to go and watch a due diligence process, right? So it's kind of made for TV, and it's really just an expression of interest. It's not a formal commitment to invest.
Yeah,
that's really interesting. So let's stay with the pitch for a moment, because there's a lot of focus on that, as you say, and there is just an abundance of opinions and memes and posts on LinkedIn and Instagram and TikTok about, you know, what a perfect pitch looks like. Can you lead us through the key ingredients and some of the pitfalls that whole, you know, kind of world might miss that entrepreneurs and startup teams fall into? Because it goes both ways, I'm guessing.
Yeah, so, I mean, in terms of a great pitch, it is, you know, it does come to telling a great story, but we can use tried and tested principles for communication. So in my book, I talk about a 5-act structure. So organizing your content into 5 acts, 5 chapters, whatever you want to call them. And the reason I use a 5-act structure is because we've actually been communicating in this way for centuries. So I think the ancient Greeks were the first people to write plays in 5 acts. Shakespeare is all written in 5 acts. You know, historically, we've communicated in these 5 phases. And when I'm not going to go into the detail on playwriting, but if you were to Google what these 5 acts are in playwriting and you were cross-reference them with the key elements of a pitch, they're remarkably similar. And I make the comparison in the book. And it's a great way to structure a narrative. So you've got the initial hook, which draws you in, makes you want to continue reading the pitch or engaging in the presentation that's happening. And that's got to be, you know, your big vision beyond making money, maybe some incredible piece of traction that you've got that's just going to blow them away. Mm. But something that makes them sit up and take notice. Then you've got the second act, which is kind of the essence. You know, now we've got them hooked, let's quickly and clearly unpack the essence of the business. What's the value proposition? What problem are you solving? Why does this need to exist in the world? Now you've got them kind of intrigued by this idea, probably thinking this sounds really good. This is a really cool idea. Now we need to convince them that it's not just you that thinks this is a great idea, not just your mates, not just them sitting there getting kind of carried away by this enthusiastic founder pitching this incredible vision, that it's actually something the market wants and needs. So we have the third act, which in playwriting would be the climax of the story. And this is the climax of your pitch. This is where you get the ultimate buy-in. Because here you share the evidence you have around it. Investors call it traction or validation. And depending on where you are in your development cycle, it's either validation that this is something the market wants and the market needs, or it's actual traction of people adopting your product and doing so at an ever-increasing rate. But either way, you're providing evidence and social proof and fact that backs up that the vision is something people want. There is demand for it. Then you have the fourth act, which is the plan. Here's a summary of the business plan, 4 or 5 slides, just saying this is what we intend to do in the short and the long term to grow this business and deliver you a return on your investment. Setting the scene that there's a credible plan to actually go through if they were to take the conversation forward, if they were to book those second meetings, if they were to invest their time. Then you have the fifth and final act, which is the ask. Don't forget to ask for the money. Have a call to action. Set next steps. This is how much we're raising. This is the deal terms we're expecting. If that all works for you, let's continue the conversation. So you have that ask. You have that close, that call to action. So if you can create that five act structure, what you're really doing, the reason this works is psychologically, you have the first couple of acts, which is creating an emotional connection with the investor. It's speaking to their heart. It's getting them to buy into the vision and the value proposition, getting them excited by what you do. You then have the plan and the ask on the other end, which is all the logical information, the plan, the financials, the money. It's speaking to the head. It's getting a logical buy-in. And then you have the connection between the two, the evidence, the third act in the middle. And that is transitioning the narrative. It's using social proof, fact, evidence to support the emotional feeling. And in that moment, you're transitioning the brain from the sort of the heart to the head, the emotion to the logic. So you're making it easy for the brain psychologically to absorb the information. You're taking them on this emotional and logical journey. And I go back to mine and my business partner's experience in marketing and advertising. And any good marketing campaign, any good advertiser will say you need to speak to the head and the heart. You can only sell a product when you've got that. You can speak to the head and the heart. You get the emotion and the logical buy-in from the customer, and then they will buy your product. And it's just applying those same principles to raising investment. As I say, the product is now the shares and the customer is now the investor. And it's as simple as that.
Where in your experience do people struggle most with those different different acts?
I think the thing they struggle with most is clarity, because less is more. With any, again, go back to advertising, marketing, communication that makes you want to buy something or engage in something, less is more. The best headlines, the best ad campaigns are so simple. And there's a tendency for founders to try and be too clever or try to explain too much about their incredible idea. And your pitch becomes a full business plan. It becomes 50 something slides, hundreds of words, and no one wants to engage in it. Less is more, because if they're intrigued enough, they'll want to invite you in for a meeting, or they'll want to take questions and go through this due diligence process to find out more. If you try and give them everything all at once, they're just going to switch off. They're going to glaze over. You're going to get that sort of zombie stare of just kind of, I'm lost. I don't really know what you're talking about. And founders often think that when they get questions in a pitch, it means they miss something out in their presentation. They should have said that. And they go away and they add a slide or they add a bit of content to cover that, so they don't get asked it again. The fact that the investor's asking you questions means the pitch has done its job. They're engaged enough to want to find out more. If they're not asking questions, you've lost them. There's no relationship to be built. You can't build rapport because you're not having a conversation. They're just going, oh, thanks very much for your presentation. Shut the door on your way out. I'll be in touch. That is not the result of a good pitch. You know, and you're walking out going, brilliant, no questions. I must have nailed that. No. Less is more. Invite them in give them just enough nuggets to make them say, tell me more about this bit, tell me more about that, and then you've got rapport. Now you're building a relationship, and now you can showcase yourself to be a really good strategic entrepreneur with a plan and a plan of action. You know what you want to do, you've got insights in your market, and you can build a relationship with these people that are ultimately backing you and your vision. And you know, that's what this is about. It's just relationship building.
John gives me the zombie stare all the time, so I know what that feels like.
We've all had the zombie stare at some point.
Less is more, Scott. Just remember that.
So, James, how does the entrepreneur get into the head of the investor to really connect with what they care about?
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult when you're not an investor yourself, but it's the same. You're not necessarily the customer of your product, and you're able to get into their head and understand what they want. That's usually through market research, right? You talk to your potential customers and you find out their wants and their needs. So the best thing a founder can do is months, possibly years ahead of when they're actually planning on raising investment, start attending pitch events, networking events, talking to investors, finding out their wants and needs, what they care about, what they like to see in a startup, and then you've got a bit of an insight as to what they're looking for. The other thing you do is start reaching out to them and saying, look, I know you invest in my space. I'm not looking for money. I'm 6 months away from raising any investment, but I'd love to just pick your brains. I'd love to find out what I don't want to waste anyone's time. So I want to know what I need to achieve myself before you would be interested in even having a conversation with me, let alone investing. And then you can start to draw insights as to, okay, until I get to this stage, until I've been able to achieve these things, there's not really much point in me going out there pitching for investment. Mm. The other thing to think about is like, what is the desire of an investor? The desire of an investor is to realize a return, right? And they're taking a strategic gamble with their cash, and it's no different to gambling. They're picking maybe 10 companies a year to invest in, maybe more depending on how much they've got to invest, and they're making strategic bets on these companies, hoping that one will pay off and the others will fail, but the returns from one will pay off the other failures. And the game, if you like, is to try and pick as many winners as possible. And that's what they're trying. So they see you instantly as a risk. You're a risk to them, but are you a good risk? And can you deliver them outside returns that not only deliver the return that they would want from an investment into a company, but also pay off all the losses that they're going to make on the ones that don't fail? So if you think about a typical VC firm, they might make, there's something called the VC power law, and they might make, say, 100 investments with their fund, and they would expect 1% of those, so one of those investments, to deliver something like a 50 to 100, maybe 150 times return on their investment. That's the outsized winner. You then might have 3 to 4% make a 5 to 10 times return. Then you might have a few break even, and the rest are going to fail. So they're making a strategic decision. Every single investment that they make, they have to believe can deliver that outsized return. There's no point going to pitch to them and say, I can get you 5 to 10x. Every single one, because they know 99% aren't going to achieve it, one will. They don't know which one that is. So every single one has to be able to show them how they're going to get 100, 150x return. And unless you can show and convince them of that, you're not going to win their investment. You're not going to say, I'm going to be one of the people that gets the 5 to 10x. It doesn't work like that. They're the ones that ultimately haven't delivered what they promised. Still a decent return, but it's not the work. Because a VC fund's got institutional investors in that they've promised a 3x return to, typically. So they've got a 100 million fund, and they're promising to return 300 million to their investors. And the way they do that is by making big gambles on startup businesses, hoping that one of them will get 150 times return, pay back all the losses, and be able to deliver their investors the 3x return they promised them. So really understanding how VCs operate, and that most angel investors, as I say, in Europe and the UK, certainly are ex-VCs or ex-finance people, they're thinking in these numerical terms of kind of going, I've got X amount to spend, I'm going to split it across X number of deals, and if they've all got the potential of achieving X return, and I have a 20% stake in all of them, and they're all going to be diluted by three rounds, so my returns would be X based on all of this data, and that's my investment strategy. And it becomes a game of numbers, essentially. And so the more you can sort of absorb about how these investors think. The phrase I often say is that great ideas don't raise investment, great communication does. No one's investing in you because you've got a great idea. They're investing in you because of all of the other things I've talked about today. The founders that think it's the strength of their idea that will raise them the investment are the ones that will fail. If you're going around going, I've got a brilliant idea, give me your money to make it happen, you're just not going to win any investment at all. No one else cares about your idea, only you care about your idea.
So you, in the book, you talk about the fact that, just to pick up on this idea of trying to get the financial perspective on this, that many startups, because they're operating on a hand-to-mouth way of working, it's just inevitable, but that also influences how they think about their long-term funding journey. So how do you help them to break that short-term thinking so they can get successfully into that scale-up phase?
Yeah, it's a challenge, because you do just tend to focus on the short term. So when I mean, a lot of what we do in the preparation before we even start producing any of these materials or preparing for investment is to take our clients through a strategic planning process of kind of pulling them, asking them the right questions to pull themselves out of that short-term thinking and kind of going, how does this map out in the longer term? What's the ultimate goal here? And let's work backwards from there. So what exit do we need? What do you believe you can achieve? What do you want to achieve in terms of ultimate valuation and potential exit? How does that align with what investors want to see? And how can you plot things back from there? So if we need to hit, say, 50 million in 5 years to satisfy an investor, how do we make that happen? Is it just pure sales and marketing and growth into capturing market share? Or should we be making strategic acquisitions of other businesses to increase the overall valuation of the company and sort of actually buy in resource and value and those sorts of things? There's loads of ways to make that happen, and it's not always the obvious. It's just about kind of working back from, one, getting alignment in terms of your vision and the investor's vision and making sure that you're comfortable with presenting something that an investor would feel comfortable with. And that, you know, if you have the ambition to grow your company, but you want to be in that company for the next 20 years until you retire and it's your pension plan, it's probably not aligned with what investors want, which is a return in 5 years. So you either need to be accepting of the fact that you might want to shift those goals if you want investment, or accept that perhaps the majority of investors won't be interested in your opportunity because you're not looking to exit quick enough or scale fast enough. So it's all about just kind of getting alignment and then working back from there and going, how do we actually make that happen? And then once you've plotted that, it's kind of going, so what's our next strategic milestone, which is usually either break even or your next round of funding. This round of funding gets you to one of those two points in time. And then what are the day-to-day, month-to-month tactics that we need to spend this money on now to get to that next strategic milestone, so then we can unlock that future growth and that future potential. So yeah, that's kind of the way we do it.
Thank you.
If you're enjoying the show, you might also appreciate Scott's new book, The Enneagram of Emotional Intelligence, which provides simple, powerful tools to help us better understand ourselves and others. Available online at all major retailers.
Is AI having an impact on the sort of pitching investor landscape?
Yeah, I think obviously, you know, AI is huge right now and there's always trends. If we cast our mind back to lockdown 2020s, there was the NFTs, and blockchain and NFT was huge, and people were raising tens of millions of dollars without even a pitch deck. They were just turning up, telling people about their NFT platform, and people were throwing money at them, right? I spoke to someone a few months ago who did that, exited their business, and is now looking to raise funding in the current climate for another blockchain business, and is going, I'm at my depth, I've no idea what's going on. Last time they just threw money at me, what's happened? So there's always these trends, and there's always going to be investors that get caught up on these trends, and AI is clearly the most recent one, although it's sort of been bubbling away for a long time. So I think the thing that founders do that's probably a mistake is that they try to capitalize on these trends. So for me, a good business case, good idea, doesn't rely on blockchain or AI or any of these technologies, really. They solve a problem. They solve a meaningful problem for people. And the AI or the machine learning or the blockchain is just a tool that enables you to realize that value proposition. So unless it's built upon a genuinely, you know, desirable value proposition and can be delivered at a price people are wanting to pay and delivers a result that they want, then it doesn't really matter about the technology. The technology just facilitates that happening more quickly, more cheaply, more cost effectively. So I think there's a tendency to just go, I'm going to build an AI business, and then what does that business need to be, without really it coming from a core value proposition that actually works in the market. So there's a tendency to just chuck AI or something like that into the business. So we were solving this problem. We've been doing it this way. Oh, maybe if we add AI into the pitch, we'll be able to target a load of AI investors and we're more likely to raise funding. And it's just kind of a bolt on to try and open some doors. And it's not really needed. It's not really wanted, not been tested on the market. So I think there's a tendency to just kind of leverage these trends and try and use those to open doors. And it never really works because the investors that genuinely invest in AI know a bit smarter than that. They know that you're not really what they're looking for. So I guess it's kind of a double-edged sword there. It kind of stimulates investment and it stimulates demand, but it also means that you can fall into the trap of just kind of sticking AI on to try and capitalize on that trend. And we saw it with blockchain and NFTs that happens all the time. On the sort of other point of kind of can founders leverage it, I mean, I think it's a great tool, right? If used in the right way. But in terms of, I mean, we've been testing it, right? Who wouldn't go, can we shortcut some processes or do things with AI? And it's just not good enough right now to do proper strategic thinking. It's not that good at making great sense of communication either, to be honest. It's all very generic. It's all very, you know, you spend as much time trying to kind of craft the prompt for ChatGPT than you do actually. You might as well have just done it yourself. By the time you've crafted the prompts and then re-edited everything, it's regurgitated. We've just not found it to be particularly great at this kind of stuff, because it's very, you know, every business is so unique and nuanced, and it, you know, it spits out stuff that sounds good, but it doesn't really mean anything. It's sort of meaningless. It sounds good and you first read it and you think, oh, that's really good, and then you read it again and you think it actually doesn't mean anything. It's just words on a page. so I think we're seeing this across, like you can see that with content marketing and, you know, all areas. People are getting quite good at spotting AI regurgitated content because it's meaningless. So I think it's got a long way to come before it can be a genuinely useful tool for communication and business strategy. But you know, may I'm happy to be proved wrong, but I think we're quite a way away from it being genuinely useful.
So we focused a lot on, you know, how you win the investor over. What should the startup or the entrepreneur be looking for in that investor, both, you know, good and bad? What are the kind of pitfalls in trying to find the marriage?
Yeah, and that's what it is, right? A marriage. They're going to be with you for a long time. So you need to, you know, as much as you want their money, you also need to make sure the relationship's right. And, you know, first rule of thumb is go with your gut. If you're unsure, you feel uneasy with this individual, this is probably a good reason. Do your own due diligence on them. You know, ask them for a portfolio of founders, contact those founders. What's this investor like? If they're not willing to give that up, it probably means they're a pain in the ass. If you speak to those founders and they'll say one of two things. They'll say, absolutely great. They're so helpful, so supportive. They let us do what we're good at, but they also are happy to give us strategic advice if we ask for it, but they're not a nuisance. Or they're going to say, oh, they're a real pain. Every week they're contacting us. How are things going? I spend as much time reporting back to these investors than I do actually getting on with growing the business. They're a real nuisance and a real pain. So try and find out from other founders what they're like. We've got a list of questions that we give our clients as to what they should ask investors. While investors are, you know, putting them under the spotlight and scrutinizing them, feel free to hit back with your own questions of about their experiences and how do they operate. Are they passive? Are they active? Do they want to be heavily involved? Do they want a board seat? Do they want to be an advisor? Are they happy to just not have any involvement? How often do they want to be reported to? What do they care about in terms of what's reported? You know, just figure out what they want their involvement to be, and you know, there is no right or wrong about having a passive or an active investor. It's got to align with what you want. You don't want to be expecting a passive investor and then to end up with three or four very active investors that all are fighting for attention and time and trying to give you input and pulling you in different directions, making sure they really align with your vision. Because if you've got a vision to do this and they're coming in because they see the opportunity for something very different and you're not quite aligned with that yet, they're going to be forcing you into an area where they feel they can get a return, which isn't quite what you had in mind. So a good example of that is we've got a client right now who's building a marketplace for secondhand bikes, right? It sounds fairly simple. The investors that are interested in this have spotted the opportunity of the data that they can collect through this platform being highly valuable to the cycling industry. They'd not really thought about this as being particularly valuable or anything they really cared about. They just wanted to realize their original vision. But they're actually really, you know, they're really on board with that. And they're like, my eyes are open. This is so cool. I want to learn more about it. And that investors come on as an advisor and they're working together towards this shared vision. But it could have easily gone the other way, right? I don't want to be a data company. I want to do this. And had they decided to work together, then there'd have been a constant conflict along the way. So, you know, it's about making sure you're making that right decision and you find out as much about them as they're trying to find out about you, I think.
So staying with investor relations for a moment, I'm curious about when things don't go according to plan. I imagine that some entrepreneurs may feel tempted to sort of avoid telling investors early that things aren't going to plan and they may need to be rectified. What's your advice on transparency and timing and how do we approach bad news?
Yeah, I think just like you would in probably, or at least how you would expect yourself to behave. You don't always do it in the situation, right? But if you were to think about it in any other situation, you would say, be open, be honest, be clear, be, you know, if you can bring them in, you know, these most investors are experienced individuals either through themselves in business or through having experience of the various portfolio companies they've invested in and seen failure in the past. So leveraging that insight and those skills can only be beneficial, right? So regular reporting saying, we haven't quite achieved this and therefore we're going to be a bit short of cash. Our cash flow is now getting quite tight. We're probably going to run out of runway sooner than we thought. We might need to bring that round forward, but then are we quite in a position to close that round? Because maybe we need a bridge round. The more you can do to sort of talk about these things and talk about how you're planning on rectifying them, things you can do to extend the runway, the more open you can be with the investor, the more they see that you're managing this situation as best as you can, and the more likely you are to win their support, both in terms of advice and guidance, to kind of sit down with you, have a chat, strategize how you might be able to turn things around, but also win their support. And we've seen this with clients as well, win their support in terms of bridge funding, so they know you're onto the good thing. A couple of things have not gone quite how you anticipated, but what you're building is valuable, and they believe that you will get there. And maybe you need another couple hundred K just to see you through the next few months so that you can then raise your next round of funding. And if you've been open and honest with them along the way, and they can kind of almost tell that this is going to happen at some point, they're kind of already prepared to kind of step up and make that happen. Because they've got a choice at this point, right? They can either lose everything they've invested so far and let you fail, or they can work with a founder they believe in who's moving in the right direction, albeit at a slightly different pace than they hoped, and put a little bit more cash in to see them through because they believe that that is, you know, it's better doing that than lose everything I've put in so far. So they've got a decision to make. You can make that decision easier by being open, honest, and bringing them along the journey, I think. So that would be my approach if it were me. But
Yeah, makes sense.
As we come to the end of our time, what's a final piece of advice or kind of inspiration for entrepreneurs facing this, you know, this road ahead, getting funding and moving through the journey?
Yeah, I guess one, recognize that it is tough and only a small number of founders succeed at raising investment, and you really do have to put the time and the effort into it. Until you put the time and the effort and focus on it, you're probably not going to raise investment. I think you can easily get swallowed up by these TechCrunch headlines of so-and-so's gone and raised $10 million for their idea, and they haven't got any, they haven't built anything, and you think you can raise $10 million for your idea too, and realizing that they make the headlines because they're the exception, not the rule, and really look to understand the audience that you're pitching to, which is the investor. What do they want to see? Try and do less, more with less. Try and break that funding journey down into sensible strategic steps and raise little and often rather than go for the big ask, and you're much more likely to succeed. And then the final thing is, as I said, understand that great ideas don't raise investment. Stop just pitching a great idea thinking that people will see how brilliant it is and just throw money at you. Do the work to convince them that you're the founder they can trust with that vision to turn it into reality, and you know exactly what you need to do and when you need to do it to make that happen, and present yourself as a very impressive and credible business leader as opposed to someone with an idea. And if you can do those things, you're going to be successful.
So on that note, I'd really recommend James's book, because you provide a much more detailed analysis and set of recommendations and frameworks and questions and all sorts of things that will really help the entrepreneur walk through all the stages that we've talked about. It was a really great read. Thank you.
No, you're welcome.
Yeah, James, thank you for your time and your insights. Super useful, super actionable. And if somebody wanted to contact you for coaching, could they do that? What's the way to get in touch with you?
Yeah, I think LinkedIn is probably the quickest and easiest place to reach out. So just find me on LinkedIn, or you could go to the Robot Mascot website, robotmascot.co.uk. From there, you can get a copy of the book for free. You can take a quiz to assess your investment readiness. You can book into a fundraising strategy session. That's like a weekly 90-minute session I do where I unpack all of this in a bit more detail. So yeah, loads of sort of free resources and things to sort of set you off on the journey from that site. So yeah, they're probably the two places to head.
Brilliant. Well, friends, thanks for joining us today. And remember, the world is evolving. Are you?